This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded October 28th, 2015, episode 273, Part Choice Triathlon. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gammel of Contextual Electronics.
I need to change my intro. It's boring.
Start a new brand, man. I did that for years.
Right. And a new brand.
And I'm Chris Gammel of Chris Gammel's Analog Life and chipreport.tv and Electricious and a bunch of other crap that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. I was going to say, how'd all those work out for you?
Hey, man.
Not but everybody, you had a go. That's amazing.
Not everybody can be a winner on the first one, okay?
Right.
It's okay to keep trying.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So
what's been happening? What'd you go to?
I went to an event last night. I saw people last night, Dave.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I went to the gym last night. I saw people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, how's your knee? I saw your picture of your knee.
I talked to a couple of them. Yeah, I'm hobbling around.
Yeah.
I'm doing all right.
You're getting old, man. What'd you
do? I spent most of yesterday. I went to the physio, the doctor, then to the medical center to get x-rays and ultrasounds and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so I did a gym injury to my knee.
Lifting too hard? So, too much Pilates?
No.
Too much yoga?
Spinning,
too much bike,
jumping, and you're supposed to do 180 degree jumps. And being the enthusiastic person I am, I regularly do 360 degree jumps instead of 180. And I landed wrong. And
no one saw that coming. Yeah,
not at all.
My wife's grandfather has a phrase about that. He would say to you, he'd say, because, he's a farmer in Ohio. He's like, you know, Dave, you're no spring chicken.
Right. Yes. I know the phrase.
Oh, you know that phrase. Okay. I never heard it before him. So, yeah.
Really?
Maybe it's just old person phrase.
It's an old person phrase, which is why I've heard it. Yep.
I like it, though. I like it a lot. Yeah.
I'm no spring chicken. That's correct. But I think if anyone tried to land it the way I landed it last week, then something's going to go snap. So, yep.
Well, I wish you a speedy recovery. And
I hope so, because in 3 weeks, I've got the Tough Mudder.
Oh.
In 3 weeks. In three and a half weeks.
I have to say, you've shifted to a weird hobby from, working on electronics in your daytime and doing hobby electronics in your free time. Now you're... Hobby electronics is your daytime, and you're run through the mud.
Free time
is
doing obstacle racing. Yeah,
in the mud, it's always mud.
Not always, not always.
I don't know,
but usually,
yeah. There's a lot of mud. That stuff's gross.
So I'm hoping to be fully recovered.
Cool.
Or at least recovered enough that I can push my way through it.
Yeah.
Through the 20 kilometers of. Yep.
Dang.
How many miles is that? Divide by 1.6.
Yeah. 15, 12, I don't know.
Yeah, something 13. Like that.
Yeah. Cool, man. Well, good luck.
Thanks.
So I left my house yesterday, which is different for me.
Very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
where did you go?
I went to an opening at my alma mater. So I went to Case Western Reserve, which is here downtown, kind of closer to town in Cleveland. And... our former guest.
How far is that from your place? How close are you to the Big Smoke?
I'm like a half hour drive from downtown most days, like no traffic, but where...
That's probably the same as me then. So you're in the middle of the burbs, as me.
Yeah, you knew that. I mean,
it takes me half an hour for me to drive from here to the city.
Yeah, right. So what's that like? I mean, it's like 20, 22 miles for me, so whatever that is, kilometers.
Right, yeah, it's like about 35 almost, Ks or something for me. Yeah.
But the thing is, in the school I went to is like right in the middle. There's no highway access or anything like that. So
right.
So
it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, exactly. And that's fine. But so went back down there, though, talked to Larry. So Larry was on the show, I don't know, he was like our second in studio guest ever, because Martin Lorton was also here. I guess we had Jeff when I was in a hotel room, but anyways.
Right.
So Larry's been, since we've last talked to him, he has been raising money and donating his own
Larry
money
who?
As well. So
people are going, Larry, yeah.
Oh, sorry, Larry Sears. And so he was on the show. I forget the name of the show. You know, it's one of the alliterative titles. But he's been raising money from donors and stuff like that. Raised about $35 million. They bought a building.
Crikey.
Yeah. Not a small amount of money. And a good chunk of that was him and his wife also donated.
Well, it's good to have that money to donate. But yeah. how the hell do you raise $35 million for a... Well, I won't spoil it. Tell us what it is.
Oh, right. So they bought a building. It's a 7-floor former cold storage building where they used to store like luxury items for the rich of Cleveland when rich people used to live in Cleveland.
So they actually bought it. They didn't rent it. They actually bought it.
Yeah, right. So it's right on the campus, but it's been abandoned for years. And knocked out some
because
of the walls.
Because it's Cleveland and you can, buy a big
house for the price of a VCR.
Right.
No, but this is a little different in down by the schools, you know, because that price goes up. Anyways, so they
is it part of the university campus?
Yeah, it's right on campus. Yeah, it's right on the edge of campus,
right.
I guess.
So why would a big university like that have some derelict rundown building, unused building on it?
You know, people hold out on selling stuff or there's just no use for it for a long time, so.
So did the university own it or was it privately owned?
No, it was privately owned before that. It was right near the train tracks, too. It's weird. Anyways. So they bought it, and they turned it basically, so it's 7 floors of like a former storage building, so it's all like concrete walls, stuff like that. 7 floors, 50,000 square feet, which is, what did we calculate? 4,600 square meters.
You punched it into Google, yeah.
Yeah, 4,600 square meters of innovation space, and that includes...
Wank word.
Yeah, well,
wank
sorry.
Word, wank phrase of the day.
Yeah, and I think I brought it up on here before, though, but basically, last night was the opening. It's, you know, so it was like... floors of metal shops and wood shops and electronic shops and stuff like that. And
that is 92 times the size of my lab.
Yeah, I mean, it's the biggest one I've heard of yet. I know that Georgia Tech has a really big one as well.
How do you fill up that amount of space with stuff?
That's the thing. It's not all stuff. So they've got like a lot of like open workspace type areas and then also a lot of there's a lot of that isn't built out yet.
How many floors was it?
7 floors.
Eight. Seven floors. How do you fill up seven? But even if you had them empty and used them as workspaces in quote marks, I mean, like.
Yeah, it was.
Wow.
It was not small, for sure. And and that's the thing. It's not full yet. Like, so even it's not.
Right,
it's not completely full yet. So, but then there's offices, stuff like that, and you know, there's like a patent office, not a patent office, but like an innovation or like a tech transfer office there, that kind of thing. So
what's the idea? Is there staff running? I presume there's staff running this with this amount of money investment. Did they just build it and expect people to come? Or
No. They've actually had like a on campus like reduced area. So it used to be like 4,000 square feet. Whatever.
Oh, right. Okay. So they're upgrading.
Yeah.
Right.
So the they've known about this for a while, and then so 4,000 is 370 square meters. And so they've had staff and they've had equipment and stuff like that. But now they're just building. Yeah, I mean, they've been, that was the plan has always been to this. So,
right.
So, yeah, it's great. And, you know, got to.
I'm surprised they can get enough people to make it a viable business. I mean, who would in, like, just from a business point of view, I know, like, this is fantastic, right? It's brilliant.
Oh, well.
Who would invest in this? Where's the return?
No, it's a school. I mean, like this is like alumni donation type stuff. I mean, it's not.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not like VC
right.
money or something.
It's not
like
VC, right? Okay.
Right. But I did talk to them, so I know a bunch of the people there already, and I didn't realize it's actually open to the public too. Like that's what's crazy about it. So
wow,
I might be recording from there.
But you have
to
join though, right? You've got to have a membership, right? Just like most other big hacker spaces.
Nope.
Really?
Yeah, as far as I know, you don't have to. I was asking that, and I was like, well, what's the fees? Like, or do you have to be an alumni?
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. You just have to be registered so that they have your info. And
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
My hat's off to everyone who donated and
yeah, right.
Behind that's incredible.
Well, this is a growing trend actually. So prior to Case, the biggest one I had heard about was at Georgia Tech. And Georgia Tech has one that is very big as well. I'm not sure quite how big it is, but it's in a very similar style and size, I believe. So, and Georgia Tech's like top engineering school as well. So, I'm not sure what it's called, Innovation Lab, something like that. You know, they all have similar
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, it usually involves innovation in the title.
Right,
yep.
Right. Mm. But you know, it'll be interesting. I think ultimately the thing that it comes down to is for all this stuff, like you mentioned, it's staffing, right? Because staffing is really important to make sure that people are being safe first off. But then, you know, just even just knowing how to like utilize a tool, right? I mean, like there's a big difference from like understanding what like a milling machine is and actually understanding first off. Next step is how to use it. And then the next step, which is like the higher level function of like, well, what can you really use this for, right? I mean,
you can't just open a space and fill it with stuff and expect people to come in and magically use it.
I think that happens a lot though, to be honest. I mean, like it does.
Which is why I said you've got to have staff there. You know, it's got to be staffed.
And almost like, and it's got to be like a certain mindset too. It's not just like, and so like I said, I know some of the staff there, they're really good. I mean, it's almost like you need to have mentors there as well, right? Because
Of course. No, that's what I mean by staff, not just, some front desk receptionist who takes down your name when you come in, No, I'm talking about,
Well, I mean, like, so I know a lot of people
with a gray
like,
beard there, so
with,
you can
like,
go
contextual
up
electronics and stuff like that. Even a lot of people say, well, like, what? I don't even know what the range of things that I can build. You know, like, that's one of the harder things to understand, too. Like, I can see the example projects out there, but then kind of going outside those areas and being like, oh, well, I think I could build this thing. And like, even just getting to the point where it's like, I think I could do X and I'm willing to go try it. Sometimes having someone there to just be like, yeah, I mean, go try it. I'll kind of help bound of the things that we know. Like there's a lot of steps in there, and there's a lot of kind of bolstering people's confidence enough to the point where they feel like they could build something, and then testing it out and stuff like that. That was really nondescript, but people could build stuff, but they don't know.
So this is the biggest such space in the US?
Well, no, I don't know. My question. I don't know. It's the biggest one I've heard about.
It's one of the biggest. All right. And it's in Cleveland.
Yeah, man. Well, I mean, I don't know. Tech shop's really big, too. That's the thing. Like, all the tech shops that are around the world.
Have they got... I don't think there's one in Australia, is there?
Tech shops?
Yeah.
I don't think
so. It's like a franchise, right?
Yeah, so that is a for-profit thing. And, so as far as I know, there's like three in the Bay Area. There's one in Pittsburgh. There's one in Detroit. There used to be one in North Carolina. I think that one closed. There's one in
And Tech Shop
Austin.
Is a commercial thing, right? It's
Correct.
A for-profit
right.
thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like you right. pay like 100 or 125 bucks a month
to be a member. Yeah, yeah, and you can come right. in and use the stuff. Right.
Oh, here we go. Locations. Yeah. And this one's saying 15,000 square feet for the tech shop. So.
Okay.
Oh yeah. So they say Chandler, Arizona, Mid Peninsula, San Francisco, San Jose, Detroit, St. Louis. I didn't know about that one. Pittsburgh, Austin. Actually, the Austin one is the one that's built onto like a Lowe's, which is a like a hardware store. And then DC.
Lowe's here is a clothing store.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's a enterprising family. Oh, St. Louis isn't open yet. That's why. So, yeah. Right. So, St. Louis and LA
are
open.
So, we don't have one of those here.
Yeah. And, they keep opening them, but, yeah, there's not Cleveland. So, but who cares now? So, yeah.
Very cool.
Who was I talking to about this recently? I was talking to a friend about this. I forget who it was, though. And they're saying, like, it almost comes down to like, well, what is the point really of like hackerspaces, makerspace, a lot of that stuff? Like a lot of it feels like the community kind of set up, and some of it's the equipment, but you know, we've talked about that on the show before too. Like a lot of people just want the equipment on their basement, or like they can afford it themselves, so they don't really need it, you know?
Exactly.
So it's kind of that weird mix between like obviously at a school, well, if you're living in a dorm room, that's way different because you need access.
I was going to say, yeah, no, it requires a certain type of person to join a space like this and get the most use out of it, because you've got to be conveniently located to it.
Right, exactly.
You know, you've got to, like you a know, city, me, right? I like, can't go joint, yeah.
Yeah.
I could have one here in Sydney, and I'm not going to join it because I'm just not going to be able to get there.
Right.
You know, it's just, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Unfortunately, that's the unfortunate aspect of these things. You know, you've got to build it around a community, and that's usually like a university type, you know. Yeah, where you've got people living in dorms and things like that. They're on campus. They just wander over.
Well, and
you know,
I think cities too, right? Because like if you don't have the space.
Yeah, CBDs.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah.
So, yeah.
Sydney's just different in that respect, I think. So
then what?
We do have kind of ones like this. I mean, you know, Sydney has Robots and Dinosaurs, which is the local hackerspace and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's, you know, not terribly, you know, nothing in Sydney is terribly convenient to get to.
Oh,
it's,
right.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. I'll probably be heading down there a couple times at least. I've never been a fan of the drive down there, but definitely worth it,
right? So. But if you need to use a laser cutter or something, grabbing the keys and off you go.
Yeah. Well, especially for things like, so have you done much stenciling, stuff like that?
Stenciling,
so like solder paste stencils.
Oh right, I've done a few. Yeah
I mean, like that kind of stuff, like if you need one real quick, like I've been meaning to assemble a board, but I keep forgetting to send out for the stencil, and like I could do it by dabbing on solder paste.
So you end up hand soldering the damn thing.
Well, not even hand soldering, but just like dabbing on solder paste and then kind of mushing it together. And it's like, it works, but I've already had this board before and it bridges like crazy when I reflow it. So really I should get a stencil, but I just keep forgetting.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Having a laser cutter, I mean, like, so like I've used Osh stencils before and I really like that service. It's a great service. And I think,
but you've got to wait for it,
right? You know? Exactly, and it's actually pretty fast too. I mean, like it's a couple of days, but it's,
but still, it's a couple of days.
It's a couple of days, exactly. And like, so if I could, you know, if I could trade a hour worth of driving and then the cost of materials, it's like, oh well, then I'm done, you know. And and I did spy at this space. I knew that they had it, but I've never used one before. Excuse me, they do have an LPKF there too. And
cool,
yeah,
yep.
Have you ever used one of those? I've like I said, I've never used one.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're very nice.
The laser one or the milling one?
No, the mill.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So people who don't know, LPKF is like a, are they Norway?
They're like the Rolls-Royce brand of PCB machines, you know.
Right. And they're 20 like grand, 40 grand.
They like start at 10 grand and go up, you know.
Right.
Like,
right, versus like an other mill, which can do pretty decent stuff, but like it's going to be, you know, 10 mil minimum type stuff.
Yep.
Like LPKF actually
has... And they can do plate through holes.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They can
do
solder
masks, crazy stuff like that. And it's like, okay.
Right.
Really that, I don't think it's 20, I'm not 20 grand desperate, but, you know, maybe 2 grand desperate, you know, that might be nice.
Do they have a pick and place machine?
They don't, but I don't think that's, I don't know, like that's interesting from a prototyping standpoint. Like, do you really need one for like, you know, if you're planning on everything being a prototype, do you really need a pick and place machine?
Well, no.
Maybe like one of those manual placers, you know, like just to steady your hand.
Yes, one of those manual placing machines. Yep, that'd be handy.
Yeah, those are nice.
See, but that's interesting. Like, yeah, should such a space have a pick and place machine? Because almost by definition, pick and place machine, you know, to warrant using it and to learning the time to use it, programming it, getting everything in reels, loading it all up, blah 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 blah. You're talking production, commercial production quantities,
right? And that's when it really pays off, anyways.
Yeah, but should people who are doing commercial production quantities be using such a space?
Oh, that's good. That's a good question.
Are you allowed to use this space for commercial, you know?
Yeah, if I think that there should definitely... Well, so I've seen... I mean, I've seen some... what was it? Oh, there was a video a while back with Robert Scoble, who I'm not a huge fan of, but he was doing a tour of Tech Shop, and they were talking to a guy, and the guy was basically like, you know, he did everything right. He was reserving machine time on like one of the mills, and he was like, he was doing small production runs, like 10 or 20 pieces at a time type of thing, but it was all still, you know, it was still hand loading the stock piece and cutting it, stuff like that. And it's like, I don't know, that kind of thing. But then I've also talked to people in the past where they're like, I feel like if you have a product that's being used on like a laser cutter, like that often like the super expensive or the super popular pieces of equipment, if you're like chunking out huge blocks to, you know, make a piece of your production line, you know, gear, I don't know. I think that's kind of shady.
Yeah, you're hogging the gear. I mean...
Like if I started a stencil business and then went to this space that's nearby and started cutting stencils for people there, that's kind of shady, right? You know, that's kind of taking advantage of a community resource. It's almost like the...
It is, but it also has some benefit in that people are actually using it. There's people there. It looks like a vibrant space, and maybe that person can help out somebody else because they've got experience using that machine. You know, it's like...
That's true. So, right. Well, that's almost like a tragedy of the commons type of thing. Do you know that phrase?
No, but I understand. I think I know what you're
getting at. So the tragedy of the commons, actually, which inspired the name for the engineering commons, which was not tied to tragedy.
Right, okay.
but the tragedy of the commons is often talked about, like, if you have a centralized patch of grass in a town, you know, like an old school town.
Right.
And you have multiple...
Yep, like a park.
Yeah, like a park or something like that. And then you have multiple sheep farmers, right? And or sheep, whatever, you know, people who have sheep. And
sheep aficionados.
Yeah, right. Right. Sheep fanboys. And then they're allowed
to... all our New Zealand listeners.
Or Welsh. Come on, let's be...
All right. Yes, I know Australia has more sheep than New Zealand. Shut up. It's... You have to rub, you know,
anyways, and then they're allowed to... Or goats, whatever. And they're allowed to graze their animals there. The tragedy of the commons is that the incentive is for each person to do that as much as possible because it's a community resource that is shared by everyone. And so one person, you know, because it's a free resource, one person will be incentivized to basically take advantage of that. And because of that, it'll automatically become abused because all people try and get as much of it out of it as they can. And then they'll basically destroy that patch of grass because there's no sharing and there's no care for like regrowth, that kind of thing. So, and you know, that's environmental type stuff as well. You know, like there's the tragedy of the commons is referenced a lot. So, it's just shared resources and how they get abused.
Right. Well, that's what it comes down to, doesn't it? I mean, if you're like, if I was running a place like this, a space like this, and, you know, the pick and place, and I had a pick and place machine, it was sitting there unused, then, you know, like, if you're a commercial, like, come in and use it, you know, like, why not? It's a shame to have it sitting there doing nothing, right?
Right, yep.
And if you put
limits on something like that, then the people would be like, oh, well, it's not worth it. I can't get enough done in the two-hour blocks
they give
me.
It's not worth it, so they don't come in. So it remains unused, you know, it's like...
Did you used to have, when you were working at other companies, did you used to have like a shared part bin type of thing?
Oh, yeah, of course. We would have a company lab,
Did you have someone managing that?
At least two, maybe three companies I've worked at, We would have a lab manager who would keep all the stuff stocked and everything,
Right, well, I feel like that's a necessity too, because I remember at one of the companies I worked at, there was, you know, so we did the system where you had like the drawers. So we had drawers, and then they were just metal tins that had parts just loose in those, basically.
Right.
And, you know, and then when it gets to the point where that's empty... You had to go back. This was where they had manufacturing on site. You could go back to the, you know, and request parts and fill it back up and stuff like that. But we never had anyone who was in charge of it. And so basically you'd be prototyping, go open a tin, looking for a linear regulator, open it up, oh, this is empty.
Wah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like that's like one of those things where it's like it's incentive. Everyone's incentivized to basically take from the that centralized repository, but not necessarily replenish it because of the overhead that that causes for that individual. And so you need someone to actually do that for you. You know, you need a.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it needs to be actively managed. Otherwise, no. It you know.
Yeah. And you could say, we tell our engineers to refill it, but come on.
But no, nobody does it, right? Nobody does it. It's like, oh, yeah, there's one left, you know, like that's good enough. So you walk away because you don't have time, right? Because you've got your jobs to do. So you need to take the part you need and then bugger off, you know. You can't then just go spend another bloody hour filling out a purchase request to...
Right.
You know,
well, and this happens to us. This happens to, you know, solos and individuals all the time, too, right? Chris screws future Chris all the time.
Yeah, exactly. All the time.
You know, I was about to build three boards and I only had one part left, and that was all past Chris. And that guy did not order me new parts.
Right. And at the companies we've worked at, it's better actually if you have a production parts bin. Because, you know, often we'll have two at some companies I've worked at. We'll have like the R&D lab, right, which has its own parts and stocks and things like that. But then we'll have the production facility. It'll have its own parts and stuff that we're using for production. And, you know, usually you can go to the production bins and take stuff out of there if you need them, because they're actively managed every day.
Right,
because
that's what manufacturing people are great at, actually. They're like really, really good at that. I get in trouble a lot because I was not great at it.
So you wouldn't feel bad about taking something from the production bin because, you know.
As long as you fill out the piece of paper or fill it in the system, as long as you do everything, dot every I, cross every T, you're fine.
And?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. The danger with the system you're talking about, because I've done that too, is that you have a prototype that gets... You know, basically it's like, all right, it's built and we're on this huge tight schedule and everything, and we used all the R&D parts and stuff like that, or we used the sample parts bin, because people will just come and drop off binders full of components, you know, just like
resistors,
caps, stuff like that. And then
we would do that. Exactly. That'd be very common. Like, you know, reps come around or we'd just personally order these things, and then you wouldn't hoard them. You'd go put them in the lab.
Right.
In the communal lab. These kits.
But then it gets put in, you know, I need a 0.1 microfarad cap, and I've put it, I mean, obviously this is a very, you know, jelly bean example, but you put it into the design and everything's tested and everything's ready to go, and your boss goes, okay, can we go to production? You're like, oh, but that part's not really in the system yet, so I should probably retest and sorry. So oops.
Fun.
Well,
so what's the answer? Would you have a pick and place machine? Would you let commercial people use it? Let us know in the comments.
Oh, like add a shared space
because
type of thing.
Yeah, because when you've got a massive space like that, and you've got $35 million or whatever it is, right? Holy crap, you know?
Yeah, I think it depends on the expectations, right? I mean, like, I think there is that interesting underlying expectation of like, oh, well, someone's going to bring a product out of here, right? But I don't know.
It'd be nice from the, speaking of the pick and place, it'd be nice to have it just as a learning tool so people could actually
learn
what it's like and how they work and what the issues are.
And how terrible it'll be late nights there will be and how much hair you'll tear out.
You could have one of your staff, people who's an expert on using it, and they every month they can run a workshop. This is how you use a pick and place machine.
You know,
so that you can go and talk turkey to your assembler. Right,
when you job interviews or anything like that, right?
Anything like that, right? Yeah, so I think they should have one, just purely from an educational standpoint.
Yeah, man, I feel like I went to Case like a couple of years too early, or the school I went to.
Right,
because I mean, like Larry was there; he donated all that money, and the lab got super awesome. He started teaching that class.
Yeah,
after I left,
that's insane.
And now this thing, and I wonder though. Like, I wonder about past Chris. You know, I've been thinking about past Chris. I don't think I would have taken advantage, to be honest. I mean, like, it's like I was talking to some other people there, because there was a range of like educational type people there, and
But you weren't really a hobbyist, were you?
No, exactly. That's what I mean. Like,
that's the difference. You were just one of those, you know, 90%, 95% of engineering students who just I was there because it looked interesting, and where's the beer? You know, like,
where's the beer?
Hey, I would have been like that no matter what. Come on, Dave.
You know, yeah, but you weren't a hobbyist, but now you're a hobbyist, right?
Yeah,
you're an enthusiast, or you know.
I think I'm just I'm really into it.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, right.
And now you are, which is, you know,
yeah,
is great. But you weren't like that.
Well, what I mean though is like so. You can have, you know, a huge space like this. You can have tons of tools, but ultimately, like, one of the pieces that's missing, and even like we said with the projects and stuff like that, you don't even know what's possible. Like, I think I was talking to someone. We were sitting there staring at the DeLorean because they brought a DeLorean to this thing. It was all you know, prettied up like Back to the Future.
And we're because they've got $35 million and they can afford to hire a DeLorean
this was just
for the day.
Yeah, just for a night. It was a party party prop. Yeah, yeah, but. I was sitting there talking to someone staring at this thing and I was talking to him and he, and, you know, he, this guy was mentioning his kids and we were talking about like, you know, I brought the same thing up of like, well, you know, I didn't even know like what was possible when I was going to school. I didn't even know it was possible. Like, I didn't know that what I was doing was possible. And then I stopped and I'm like, well, what I'm doing currently wasn't possible back then, or like what you're doing was not possible back then because YouTube didn't exist then. And the same thing's going to happen in another 10 years is that there's going to be other electronics jobs or just jobs in general where it's just, I don't know, it just doesn't exist yet.
Hmm.
And it's like almost that needs to be an upfront thing where it's like, let's just kind of audit some of the jobs that are out there. I don't know, like, or like I think about all of our guests, right? So like people like Jerry, who, you know, like Jerry's making these AR headsets, right? Or Sean, who's working on the satellite things and imaging the Earth, stuff like that. Or Ben Krasnow, who's doing all the everything,
sciencey thing,
doing everything, also on YouTube, right? And it's just like, but like all of these things, where it's like none of this stuff, I mean, existed, but in very, very different forms. You know, you could say, oh, well, video games existed before Jerry got there, but not what she's doing. And, you know, space existed before Sean and the planet people were working on that stuff, but now not that cheap. You know, like, I don't know. It's just, it's so hard for people to get a grasp on that. And I could tell them to listen to the Amp Hour, but that's kind of a hard sell. You know, it's like, oh, well, you should just listen to this podcast.
Well, but has the revolution happened? I mean, the revolution was the communications revolution, the internet, the connectivity, the online commerce. That's, you know, that's already done. That's done.
But that's just
the difference between when I was a boy and
people
now, right?
But, that I mean, is Dave, the big difference. Revolutions have been happening for years and years and years. You would go someone, you know, so you're roughly 10 years older than me. Go 10 years older than you, and it's like it's almost like getting into the
tell us. What's the next revolution going to be? Chip printers.
Ah, low blow. I think low-cost robotics, I think that's going to be huge. I mean, just automation in general, you could just say automation in general. You could say the actual implementation of connected devices. You know, we're already kind of in the midst of that. We've been talking about that the past two shows. You know, anything on the hype curve, really.
For example, like 10 years ago, right, laser cutters. Who the hell had a laser cutter?
Right.
Nobody, right? Big industrial, you know, Ford had them to make, you know, they cost $1 million.
Right?
Yeah. For their plant to, you know, build cars and shit.
Yeah, for like prototyping and stuff like that. Right, of course, because it was just cost prohibitive, of course. Right? And I don't know, like biohacking and electronics you know, get put together with DNA, stuff like that. Like, I mean, like that, 10 years from now, sign me up. You know, that's the next thing, you know, like, I don't know. I literally I'm looking at the hype curve right now, and we've talked about the hype curve before, and this has Internet of Things at the peak of the hype curve right now.
Oh, God.
But honestly, like, this is actually good. This is done by Gartner. This is one of the hype curves, but it's done by Gartner, and they kind of just put different points on where they are on the hype curve. And like, that's good. I mean, that's good stuff to have here. I mean, you could say 10 years ago, how about just software-defined radio, right? I mean, like, we've had lots of people on the show about, like, Mike Osman, who's always on. And,
of course. Yep.
Oh, crud. I can't remember his name now. The guy that's at NI. Ooh, I apologize. Anyways,
because we didn't have the processing, we didn't have the, you know, the cheap RF wide bandwidth RF front chipsets and stuff. You know, it's like exactly.
So
that's completely.
But like
changed.
I mean, like thinking about all of this stuff, like even just pointing to this one idea, the hype curve, and being like, yeah, just check this out once in a while and see where things are, and you know, even just go dive into the Wikipedia pages of each one, you know, like that. That then that maybe that's a job in 5 years.
I don't see anything as big, nearly as big as an like to the order of magnitude as the communications revolution, the internet.
I think the bio stuff, honestly, that stuff is that like I. We well, first off, we should use this as a target for guests as well.
Yeah, but that's just an individual technology, like software defined radio. Like it's niche.
Yeah, no, I'm saying that's a small thing for electronics, but that's a huge thing in general. Just like the bio revolution.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that makes our industry different.
Oh.
In the way it operates.
Oh, okay.
If you know what I mean.
No, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Like you're saying just in electronics. Right. I get that.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying the revolution has already happened. You know, like I don't think Sagan in 20 years' time, right, or when Sagan's 10, for example, and then when he's 30, I don't think he'll be saying, oh, you remember when I was like, we didn't have, you know, like he's got the internet. He's got the communications revolution. Like, what's the next thing of that scale, if you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you mean. But, like, honestly, Dave, like, we can't predict that. Like, who predicted the internet?
I know.
You
know?
Like, but you admit what it sounds like you're saying is that there won't be anything like that. You're just saying you have no idea what it is, right?
I'm saying, yes, I can't think of anything. That's, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
We're not big thinking enough.
No.
Anyway.
If we were.
In other news.
We'd be really rich.
Right. In other news.
In other news. What's another news?
2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Well, 2 weeks ago, we talked about analog devices buying Maxim.
Yeah.
Wah.
Well, this isn't.
This week, 2 weeks later. No, yeah. But two weeks later, now we're going to talk about Texas Instruments buying Maxim.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, so
kiddies,
original TI buying someone else. Oh, come on.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That'll
kids,
be...
stop fighting over the little chip company and come inside.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Poor Maxim, you know, or maybe it's good for Maxim, right? Because they'll get top dollar.
Let's see. They're valued at $12 billion. Good Lord, that's a lot of money.
It is.
Yeah.
But they must be in trouble, right? If they're, you know,
I mean, they're on the block. That's what we talked about before.
They must be on the blocks. Right, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know.
Anyway, yes, there's a Bloomberg article about TI said to be in talks to acquire Maxim. Maxim has also received interest from Analog Devices. Yeah, that was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Maxim, and this part of the headline: Maxim may not sell if it can't get a high premium from the buyer. So they're really. You know, hey, we're Maxim.
This is all, honestly, this is all finance weenies. This is CEOs and finance weenies.
It's got nothing to do with the chip business.
And what we talked about before, though, so we talked about it a little bit before the show. I was talking about it, like, I've gone back and started using Webbench again, and I just went straight there.
Right.
And it's like, honestly, at a certain point, it's like, with all these big companies, it's like, I know that, like, I run a site that shows you across all the parts and all that stuff, right? But like, but like, if you just want one place, you know, you know what I mean? Like, so I just went to Webbench and I was like, well, what's the difference? You know, they're so big. It's like big monolith corporation is the same as big monolith corporation. I'll just go to one of their, you know, tools, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a perfectly adequate engineering solution.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like I'm worried that like TI will stop making chips tomorrow, or ADI will stop making chips tomorrow, or Intel will stop making chips tomorrow. They might change their name, or they might buy other people, and that causes a name change. But yeah, doesn't really affect me that much. I don't know.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Maybe in 2 weeks' time we'll. Yep.
Right.
Or a law fall over when, you know, Microchip tried to buy. Atmel, you know.
Yeah.
And it all just, it all just fell apart.
Well, someone else bought Atmel, didn't they?
Oh, did they? Oh, God, I can't remember.
Yeah, they're being sold. Atmel sells? I thought they were they the ones that got bought by Dialogue?
Dialogue, yes, Dialogue bought Atmel, of course. Oh, didn't we talk about that like last month or two, couple of months
ago?
Yeah, that
just, I mean, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Has it happened? Did it happen?
I think it's in the...
Was it a done deal?
I don't care.
Yes.
Honestly, like, it doesn't matter.
Well, who the hell's Dialogue?
Yeah,
you know,
that's
like,
the German auto. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Dialogue is nobody. Right,
right. Yeah. So it is Dialogue, 4.6 billion.
Brand recognition. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Who cares? Honestly, like, who cares?
Well, yeah, you probably care if you're an Atmel fanboy.
Well, you know what I care about, Dave, is as we go towards the singularity of one huge chip company, what happens when the one huge chip company doesn't make the thing you want anymore? What do you need? What do you need, Dave? Tell me, what do you need, Dave? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right, you need that product that you need, that yes, that machine that is just not capable of actually working.
Not yet. 10 years' time. Get Sagan working on it.
10 years still. Jesus. You shorten your time frame. It was 20 years. The bet was 20 years.
It feels like ten years has already passed. It's been 5 years. Holy crap, it's been 5 years.
Oh, man. Goodness.
Yeah. So like I said, I've been using Webbench again. So people may recall that I was really against Webbench. I think it was like when...
Why? I don't remember why you were against it.
It was super janky. It was just like, I don't know, like, it felt like it was like a... Do you remember like in old video games? Well, I don't know how much... Did you ever play video games when, like...
Yeah.
So like the old video games where it was like, you'd be like, you know, the side-scroller video games. And then, you know, the little character would be going across the screen. And you'd be like, oh, well, that must be the door because that bush is differently colored than the rest of the scenery.
Right.
You know, like, that's what...
No, I'm not following the...
You're not... Okay, so, like, because the way that the backgrounds are drawn in video games, oftentimes the piece that moved would look different than the background, right?
Right.
That's kind of what it used to feel like on Webbench.
But what was your exact problem?
The problem was that it felt super manufactured. You know, they had all these dials and like graphs, and it made it look like it was like it was calculating anything. But in fact, it was just a skin over top of something that had three options in the first place, and you could click one, two, or three, but that's all it did. And then the rest was like a background that looked like a control panel. Does that make sense?
Are you saying it didn't instill confidence in you because it looked...
I'm saying that they tried to make it look like it did all these different things, but it was all just a sheet of paper, and then only like one or two things happened, you know?
Right.
What am I trying to say it like? It's almost video games feels like I think maybe if I wasn't talking to you, if I was talking to other video game people, like, I don't know, it just feels like... It felt like a sham. That's what I'm trying to say. It felt like a sham. It's not that the data behind it was bad. It just didn't feel like there was that many options. And so I went back and tried it, and I can't tell if it's me that's changed, like I'm just more accepting of web interfaces, or if they actually put more functionality in, which I think is the case.
Or you just figured out how to use it.
Or that could be the case as well. But like, you know, so they actually do simulations now. They actually, you know, send it to the Spice engine, some central server, they do thermal simulation, stuff like that. Like, it seems like it actually does stuff. I'm not saying it's particularly useful for me, but you know, it just feels like there's more calculation on the back end, and it does feel more useful.
And you're talking about the specific power supply stuff, right? Because if people don't know, Webbench does a ton of different stuff.
Right. Yeah, they have like a filter designer and a bunch of other LED designers.
There's
stuff
a power
like that.
Architect for FPGAs and you know, like LED designer.
Right.
Like thermal simulation. I mean, it's just
Yeah, and it's crazy. And I don't need any of that other. I mean, obviously, I'm not doing FPGA design or anything like that.
Filters, clocks, and analog front end design.
Yeah, like that stuff. I mean, take it or leave
voltage
it right
references.
Now. But but the other stuff that I'm doing, like I'm just doing, you know, it's not, you know, picking out. So I've been doing this stuff for contextual electronics and just trying to find boost converters, buck converters, stuff like that. It's just getting to the point where there's just so much stuff out there, you know. And then when you get all the way to the point where, I mean, this is kind of the selling point of any tool that gives you the rest of the stuff. by the time you actually pick the part, the everything else, like, so like I remember older parts that I, you know, older switchers that I used to use, you know, maybe you standardize on a part, but then you get into it and it's like, I've seen things that have like 30 pretty in-depth equations, you know, and you got to calculate, right, you know, the inductor peak current, and then you got to actually go find
yeah,
the inductor.
Yeah. Oh,
and then
nasty. Yeah.
Once you find the inductor, then you have the, you know, the DC resistance of that thing.
That reminds me of a video I did way, way back, like, you know, number 20 or something.
Yeah.
And yeah, I had this whiteboard. I had my whiteboard filled with all these equations just for this simple DC to DC converter.
Right. And it doesn't feel that simple sheet, anymore, you know? Right?
It's like... No, exactly. It was it was ridiculously complex. You know, how to use this basic, you know, it was the MC, what is it, 34, oh God, mental block.
Yeah.
What's the jelly bean, you know, DC to DC converter that's been horribly inefficient, that's been around for 30 years.
I don't know, Dave. I've only been around for 10 myself.
34060 or something. Anyway. and yeah, I did all the equations for that. And it was like, and there were so many of them.
Yeah.
And right, it was exactly. Like, and it so, looked like the most hideously complicated whiteboard in history.
Right. And it's like, know? It's like, usually it's like there's 5 equations and 4 unknowns or 10 equations and 9 unknowns. And it's like, what the hell, man? Like, you know, especially like the like a lot of the parts have got, a lot of the switchers across all the vendors have gotten more and more integrated, where they, you know, they pull, like, a lot of them, first off, a lot of them have pulled in the, they've gone from, let me get this right, controllers to converters, right? So controllers have external FETs, converters have internal FETs. And
correct.
Because of the increase, because of just better fab technology, stuff like that, they can, a lot of them can handle more current on the actual die, and so they pull the FET internal and they become converters. Wow. And that is great, actually, because that saves, because that's a huge part of those equations usually, you know, because you have
it's a single chip solution. It's right. Another part you don't have to spec in. It's
right.
Just
right, exactly.
You know, done.
And then all those other things that are part of FETs, of, you know, on state resistance and then the gate capacitance, stuff like that, you don't have to really worry about that until you get into the higher, you know, if you're going high power, you still have to usually do that. You have to go to controllers versus converters, but yeah, removing that element simplifies a lot of things, but not everything. You know, it's still really important to pick the inductor and have all the caps set up right, and, you know, especially if you're using, like, if you're not using ceramic capacitors. I mean, I throw ceramics at everything now because ceramics keep getting better as well. So
they do.
Yeah.
So,
needless to say, it's gotten better, but it's still, you know, it can still be, it's like you get to the fit, it's like running an Ironman, right? It's like you finish swimming the 4 miles of finding your part, and then it's like, you know, time to hop on that bike for 120 miles, or whatever the hell those crazy people do, you know? and then you do that, and then you get to the end of the bike part, and you're like, all right, I'm done. And it's like, now you get to test it and run that marathon. Right? You know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Right. So it's good now. It's all good.
It's getting better. Well, that's the thing.
You're a Webbench fanboy.
Well, not even Webbench fanboy, but just like, you know, if you standardize on one vendor, often that's just another layer that you remove, right? Because if you start comparing, you know, TI to Maxim to ADI to everybody else, to LT to anyone else, right? It's like, I don't know, like, you got to evaluate all those
others. The ability to navigate their website and find parts. Every bloody manufacturer's website is different.
Yeah.
And if you always stick to one, well, you get intimately familiar with their website and how to find parts and what they got and, you know, or using their Webbench tool or whatever.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, it just makes your life easier and quicker.
Right. And everything goes great until you get to, that's like running the whole Ironman, and then you get to the end and you cross that finish line, and then your purchaser is standing there with a bat, and they're like, you single sourced a component, you piece of crap? Yeah. But I don't know, like, all these parts these days, like, unless you go super modular and, like, you know, have, oh, well, power in, power out type of thing, and there's some amorphous block in the middle.
Right.
And then, you know, I can swap it out for any vendor's parts I want to, as long as it conforms to the spec. It's like, yeah, you can do that, and some people do, and it's definitely, that lowers your risk for a lot of stuff, but that increases the hassle factor like 100x, because now you got to have an actual modular solution.
Exactly.
Or you got to pay more and actually buy a modular solution. Like, people actually...
Oh, it's a given that it's more a more expensive solution. Yeah.
Right. Like, do you ever do that? You ever buy the DC to DC modules?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to do it all the time because when...
Oh, we've talked about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. When I'm designing a piece of production test gear, you know, they say, right, we need a bit of production test gear that does this.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not going to dick around designing a DC to DC converter. Are you shitting me?
Yeah, right.
I got better things to do with my time than design a DC to DC converter. So I'm going
to
pay
$50.
Figure
out how to write code again.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm just going to go to Farnell's or, you know, not like
whoever,
local, whoever, right? You know, because budget's not an issue, right? And I'm going to buy the $50 DC to DC converter brick instead of rolling it.
Yeah.
I know I can go buy the chip and the inductor and the MOSFET and everything else for five and the diode for $5.
Right.
But it's not worth my time.
Yep. Yep.
Right? I don't want that hassle. I don't want to, in 1 month's time, when I've got to show this thing at the design review meeting, right? I don't want to have to stand up and say, oh, sorry, I haven't fixed it, haven't finished it because, you know, oh, my DC to DC converter failed and I had to respin my board and I spent all my time on that.
Yeah.
And Murphy got me. And, you know, I don't want that.
Yeah.
I'm going to pay $50 for that converter brick.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Jeez.
50.
You know,
only
nothing.
50? Let's
that,
give me
100.
I'll buy the best one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know. Because what's my time charged at? You know, $100 an hour at the company?
Yep.
You know, easily.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, at least, yeah.
And yeah. So you just, you know, like, and how many hours, even if you're the most competent DC to DC converter designer in the world, how many hours does it take you to roll a DC to DC converter solution?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You can't do it in an hour. Right? From go to woe.
Well, I think there are some chips out there that do that now, like the micro modules from LT and, you know, the simple switchers from TI, stuff like that.
Yeah, but they're...
But they're expensive,
know,
too. Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're expensive, too. So you might as well go for the brick.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And, you know, and there it is. It's all in the one module. It's got four pins. It's got two on the input. It's got two on the output.
Right, right.
And sometimes
they're isolated. That's great.
And it's already got the performance curves. I can cut and paste those performance curves into my documentation. I don't have to test it.
Yeah.
Right? It's brilliant.
Yeah, man.
Although back when I was a boy.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go.
Before
the internet. Right? You would actually go to the photocopier. You would actually photocopy the, you know, the data book, right? Because you had data, you know, none of this PDF rubbish, right? So you had to photocopy the data book. You'd get the page. You'd actually cut out the graph, you know, you'd actually cut it out.
Right.
And then you'd stick it. You'd get some glue, and then you'd stick it onto the graph sheet, you know, because we at...
I'm just imagining, back when people had glue sticks at their
desks.
Yeah.
Well, yes, a glue stick was how you did your documentation, right? We would, because we'd do everything on these A3 graph paper sheets, right? You know, the ruled, you know, the 5mm ruled grids, right? The graph sheets, everything, you know, with the ring, and when we had these A3 ring binders, and each project had, you know, 50, I'm not, you know, exaggerating, it had 50 ring binders, you know? So if I was working on my thing, working on my new production test jig or whatever it is, right? New design. I would start a new ring binder, right? And you know, and it'd have a whole number system, like the, you know, like a
lab notebook,
our
almost
company equivalent, the Dewey Decimal number system, right?
We'd
have
like
our own numbering
commit
system.
Numbers.
Right, yeah. And that was, seriously, that's how you did stuff. And then you write revision one on it. Right? And then you put it in, and then you stick all your graphs in, and then you write, you'd hand write. Okay? You would actually, I'd get a pencil and, you know, hand write on this thing, and then you sign and date the page, you know, and then you'd put it, then you'd register it, you'd put it in the ring binder, and then when you wanted to do Rev 2, well, you photocopied Rev 1, and then you make the hand changes, and then you sign that, and then you mark that as Rev 2, and then you, the photocopier and the glue stick was... You know,
right.
They were your tools of choice.
Oh man, I used to have.
Sorry for that threat. See, you've never done that, have you?
I've never done that, but I had to deal with a bunch of the old data sheets that I used would be like scanned copies of photocopied like, you know, multiple times.
They're horrible quality. Yeah,
and they're always like they're always like off kilter. They're a little bit, you know, not square to the page, stuff like that. Yeah.
Oh man,
those times are dumb.
Old Burr Brown parts.
Yeah, that was really dumb. Yeah. Ain't no OCR in that stuff.
No chance.
No.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was fun back in the day. Does anyone else have any story?
I can't believe you have any nostalgia for that.
People
honestly,
older than me.
Like none at all. Right. Like how could you possibly?
None. Right. No. It was, you know, it was horrible. But you didn't know any different. We didn't know the internet was coming.
Right.
Right. We had no idea. Right. Yes, the internet was around, but I'm talking the web, you know, and PDFs and, you know, like the internet as we know it kind of thing.
You know, I was talking to my wife about different business types the other day. She's like a business-minded person.
Right.
And we were talking about, you know, just business margins and stuff like that for the business she works for. And then we were like, oh, well, it can get worse. So you can go supermarkets at like 10% margin. And then I was like, I know one worse. You could get like, be like a component distributor and you get like 2% margin or lower. And then I started talking about like how in the old days, this is obviously way before my time, but in the old days, it wasn't 2%. It was like 10 or 20%. And that's when those are like the data book days that you talk about, when people would shop around data books. And there was actually small distributors that don't really exist anymore because they can't survive on 2% margins.
No.
Only the big guys can.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And so, I don't know, just thinking about those nostalgic days of, not nostalgic, but like, just like the difference in the industry over time, a lot of that is tied to those margins and how much money there was actually flowing to different entities and stuff like that. So, I mean, even with these big mergers, you know, every time a company buys another company, they become bigger. That allows them to produce more chips at a lower margin, you know, and then they also up their fab capacity, stuff like that. That's all for a reason, because they want to get the economy of scale, stuff like that, and you know, especially in a fab, that really matters there. So, yeah,
because ultimately they're a business that is answerable only to one person, the shareholders, and they've got to show that compounded growth, and you know,
right,
their job is not to design better chips, really. It is, you know,
to sell more chips.
It is, and innovate. It's just to get eke more margin out of the chips they make, you know, like,
yeah, and just sell more in general.
You can do both, the smart companies do both, of course, you know,
definitely.
The Danaher business technique, the Danaher business system.
I don't think Danaher is in the chip fab business, so.
No, but, you know, that's what they specialize in, you know.
Yeah.
That's why the share market love them.
Yeah.
Because they know how to milk every last cent out of every company they buy.
Yeah.
You know. And, moo.
Yeah.
Can we change the topic a bit?
Yeah, sure.
Even though we're almost up. I probably have to talk about this. It's pretty controversial.
Which one?
Are you ready for it? I have not clued you up about this.
Okay.
And you may not be aware of it, but we have to talk about Siglent, I think.
Oh, okay.
It's important.
So Siglent is a...
I didn't put it on the list.
A test equipment maker, right?
A test equipment manufacturer, scopes, you know, multimeters, power supplies, function gens, right? They make really, you know, decent low-cost gear. They're getting better all the time, you know.
I've reviewed a couple
of their products recently. And, they're certainly getting better. But they have been caught with their pants down.
Oh, yes.
The EV blog forum has exploded, has absolutely exploded, because I might have to call the thread up, actually, so I get his name right. But EV blog forum user, I'm here. It's okay.
Okay. That's...
Old School Tech Corner.
Okay.
Mr. Old School Tech Corner from the US. He bought a Siglent function generator, right? I'll tell you the story. Bought a Siglent function generator and decided to sell it. I'm not sure why he sold it, right? So he put it up on eBay. You know, brand, like, as new kind of thing, you know, because he'd hardly used it. So, you know, it's kind of selling it as new. And he got eBay took the listing down.
Oh.
And it turns out Siglent had an active policy to go search for things on eBay. If you're selling them at too low a price, they will get, you know, they'll smack eBay with a, you know, cease and desist, digital DMCA, I don't know. There's some, you know, trademark infringement, whatever. There's some debate over what it actually is they did.
Uh-huh.
They told eBay, but eBay took down the listing and, there was a huge shitstorm. It's currently up to 44 pages on the EEV blog forum.
I don't know if that's a good measure.
It's a good measure of the controversy it's creating. Right? And there's like 20 posts per page or something, 25 posts per page or something, right? It's really exploded. And Siglent have profusely apologized, et cetera, that, you know, oh, we thought it was brand new, you know, and oh, we thought you were or it was a fake. Actually, sorry, they thought it was a...
Well, I don't know.
Excuse me if I get the exact details right. They thought it was a fake product and they're getting it taken down. But the real reason is that they actually have an active policy to protect the margin of their dealers, right? So they go after people on eBay selling things cheaply.
But that's
right?
not that uncommon, though. No, that's not uncommon.
No, it's not uncommon. It's not uncommon, but it doesn't make it right.
Well, so the reason that they do it, though, is because, a lot of times there is a minimum price that is set for products, right?
For the dealers, yes. Yeah, right. Yes. But in many countries, it's illegal to tell a dealer what, including here in Australia, to tell them what price they can sell it.
Right.
Right? Usually it's what price they can advertise at.
Right, and then they could sell it lower.
So they can sell it cheaper privately under the tape, right?
Yeah.
If they want to sell it cheaper and make no money, that's their business, right? But you're not allowed to advertise cheaper.
Well, that's how cars go too, though. Is, I mean, like, a lot of cars are like that as well.
But that's authorized dealers, right? That's authorized dealers. What we're talking about here is unauthorized dealers, say me. Right, Dave Jones, I decide, I reckon I can make some money selling these Siglents, right? And I go buy them from Alibaba or wherever, right? I go buy them from wherever. Doesn't matter which grey market seller I buy them from or even from an official dealer. If I can buy them cheap enough and resell them locally for a profit at a cheaper rate than what you can buy it for from the official dealer, they can't stop me. There is no law to stop me doing that. Right? But Siglent are going around telling eBay, like putting in requests to eBay to get my listing taken down. Right?
Well, that's pretty lame.
It's lame, right? It is, like, that's probably the best description, right? It's lame. It's pathetic. Like, you know, they are probably, you know, there's debate over whether or not they can legally do it and all that sort of jazz, but who cares? You know, like, it's just lame. Right? They shouldn't be doing this. And they're being caught with their pants down. They've apologized. The listing's gone back up eventually after, you know, a huge battle. And but still, their reputation has taken a big hit over this one. So
the low end of electronics stuff is actually really interesting, I think. You know, like all of that super low cost type of stuff. Because, like, at a certain point, someone's going to go shady, right? They're either going to use counterfeit components.
Right. Yeah,
they're not going to put anything inside the box. It's at all, you know, like, I don't know. I feel like some of this is just kind of goes with the territory of, like, oh, you're buying a really cheap scope. Yeah, you might have some weirdness there. I don't know.
And the other thing, you know, one of their excuses was, oh, we're trying to protect you, the customer. You know, by, you know, but not potentially getting fake goods.
See,
well, thank you very much.
I don't hold that against them, though. I wouldn't hold that against them.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's just a bullshit excuse, right?
That's what I mean. But I wouldn't hold them against them. I wouldn't hold it against them.
it's just a shitty thing to do, and they shouldn't be doing it. Like, you know, going after people selling stuff on eBay. It's just, you know, like.
I think
if they are pretending to be an authorized dealer, yeah, definitely go after them, right? Shut them down.
Right? No, I mean, but the misplaced aggression's on your part. I think I don't really.
Why?
I don't care about this at all.
I am not alone. There is 44 pages of vitriol on the EV blog forum.
Dave, there's pages of vitriol over the internet. I don't care about this at all.
I mean,
it's the low cost scope. You guys are playing with
this. This is why I've raised it, because the community has decided this is a pretty shitty thing to do. And
sure.
Hence why there's such talk about it on the forum. It's the biggest thing going on the forum at the moment. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's got an opinion.
The biggest thing on the forum is not the biggest thing that I care about. I'll tell you that.
No, well, you don't have to care. I don't care about all the stuff you talk about.
That's
on
true.
The
that's true.
Either. I'm just.
Let's talk about robots for a little bit, Dave.
I'm just raising this, right? I'm just raising it because it's a topical thing. So there you go.
Sure.
Anyway,
yeah,
we'll
sure
link it in down below.
Some people that will care about this somewhere.
There's a lot of people on there who have said, "Right, I'm never buying Siglin again."
Yeah, but that's so much crowd mentality too, right? It's so easy to say that, and then someone's like, "Oh, well, I need a cheap scope." So
right, yeah. So they end up going and buying them.
I don't
know. Yeah. Anyway,
I'm not saying that anyone's wrong. I'm just saying that it's just like, eh. I don't know. This is why I don't care about you're all into the test equipment, like brokering, you know, like having all this test equipment stuff as well.
Yes. Yeah.
If it works, it works. That's all they care about. Just get me to the, you know, like I.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Okay. I didn't say you have to care.
Yeah.
Just bought it.
I know. I don't mean to downplay your stuff. I don't mean to downplay that you bringing this up. I'm just saying that, like, in general, like, all the test equipment stuff, I'm just like, I don't know. Like, I've said this before. I don't.
But this is not about test equipment, really. It's about...
Yeah, it's about retailing
companies
almost.
Trying to,
right?
Companies trying to shut down other people. You know, it's like, it's just concentrate on making good quality stuff at a good price. Don't dick around with doing shitty stuff like this, you know.
Okay.
Searching eBay and putting in reports and getting people flagged and taken down, you know. Like, just don't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, concentrate on building good test gear. Thank you.
Yeah. I was listening to another podcast about... it was Reply All, which is one of the Gimlet Media. Anyways, it's a podcast.
No idea.
But I think it was them. They did an interview with a guy, Ripoff Report, and how basically, like, it's like a site where people can complain about, you know, shady practices like this, or just general stuff like that. And just out on the internet, it's like sometimes there's just no recourse. So, like, the guy that runs Ripoff Report won't take anything down. And...
Oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Of
so,
course.
Like, anything that's there,
even if someone was falsely accused,
exactly. So,
you're saying,
so if
won't
someone
ever take it down,
if someone
yeah,
said,
yeah.
"Oh, well, Dave made a micro supply that had nothing in it," right? There's no way for you to have recourse, that kind of thing. So, like,
got it.
Everything internet, you know.
except go on there and explain.
Yeah, you're not allowed to.
Right? I'm free, just like someone is free to, talk bullshit on there. I'm free to go on there and defend myself.
You know? There's actually no recourse for it. That's what I'm saying.
What? I can't go... What? So it's not a forum? It's not like a... I can't reply? Is that what you're saying?
Right. Yep.
Somebody can post something there and it's gospel and nobody can talk and it can't be discussed?
I think... Or maybe it is, but you have to,
sounds
you have
like
to pay for it.
Sounds like a shitty website.
Yeah, but it's really well indexed, so... Yeah.
Right.
So next time...
Well, that's kind of like an Amazon review. You know, if you get a bad Amazon review, you know, that can be like the death of a company or a product.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Like,
and this
internet does that kind
of
thing.
Who was it?
You know?
I heard... Who? Oh, I heard it just last week or something. Somebody, some big company, was actually paying people to go and change their bad review. Oh, that's right. It was... No. It was... It was some hotel chain here in Australia or something. It might have been an international hotel chain. You know those those online hotel review.
Yep.
You know things. Yeah, they were actually actively going to people who had written bad reviews about them and offering them money to change their review to a good one because they didn't want the bad.
Yeah, man, it can affect business a lot.
It can really affect it. Yeah,
I mean, like it's crazy how fast the time. I mean, like that's what I mean though. Like. how, like, you know, like the, you said 44 pages of people vitriol, right? I mean, like, the tide could turn pretty fast, you know, like.
Oh, yeah, it's, you know.
Yeah, I don't know.
But hey, no, like, I am, you know, as a person who runs a forum where potentially people can say libelous.
Yeah, that's the right word, yeah.
Things, right? You know, look, I'm, you know, I will take stuff down if people have overstepped the mark or they're making false accusations and stuff like that. I, you know, if somebody reports it, then I will consider taking that down, certainly.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of my responsibility. I, you know, I don't want to run, you know, a forum that's a complete, and you know, that ends up like 4chan or something.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Like, it's complete nutter free for all. Yeah. You know, like,
you say complete and utter or complete nutter, because both are accurate.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
I'm sorry, 4chan. Yeah. Don't touch the amphour.com. We're sorry. You guys are crazy.
We've just got our own thread.
Yeah. Right.
We'll be, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh, they're silly. Goodness.
Anyway. Yeah.
Speaking of 4chan and places where illegal activity happens, this is from a while ago. This is from last week, but there was, so basically, you know, Chip and Pin.
Last week is now a while ago.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, right. Chip and Pin, how that's finally coming to the United States. You've guys, you and Australia and the EU has
had it for a decade. Yeah.
So we finally have it here, but basically, the title of this Ars Technica article is "How a Criminal Ring Defeated the Secure Chip and Pin Credit Cards." And you go into it, and it's like they had to solder, and it's like, well, at least the criminals are soldering.
Right? Yeah. It's win for electronics.
That's right. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Maybe they're breaking the law, but you know.
Well, don't we always say we don't care how people get into electronics as long as they get into
it? Right. Exactly. So you know, break the law by soldering. Right. At least you know how to solder, and then when you go to jail, you can teach all your jailmates how to solder as well.
So what's the deal? I won't mention the US prison
system.
No, please
don't. Yeah.
Privatization.
Oh, God, terrible.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Are they, is there much take up?
Is there much?
There, with the Luddite US who are still using checks to buy
actually,
their groceries.
Oh, actually, so October 1st was the official switchover, but apparently January 1st is like the hard switchover where everyone will use it. So.
Oh, so they're actually mandating
all of my credit cards have been replaced.
Use it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So it's good. I mean, it's good. And it's, so people don't know. Basically, what it is, it does like an authentication, though. It has like a, I think there's like a hash on board, right? There's the small chip on board, which basically it.
There's an encrypted.
Yeah, it passes
an
encrypted thing. It
mechanism.
And it decodes it, yada, yada, yada. Does a authentication. Mm. But the weird thing here is that we don't have to put in a code. I know that you guys do, right?
Yeah, that's why it's called Chip and Pin.
Yeah, so we're not.
Oh, well, no, we don't. I'll stand corrected. Anything under $100, right, we've got like RFID in them as well as the chip, right?
Yeah.
So you can actually tap it. You can actually tap and go.
Right.
Right? And it's really, you know, it's super quick. Like you don't even have, if you've only got one of these in your wallet so it doesn't interfere with another one, you don't even have to get the card out of your wallet. You just tap it.
Nice.
And boom, it's paid for, right? Anything under $100, it's widespread. I'd say probably the majority of places I use now have tap and go.
Oh, that's cool.
As well as the
And that's like a really
Have your cards got the RFID thing in them?
I'm sure they do,
you can usually see like the wires around the outside. You can usually tell.
Let's see. I've got my wallet here.
No.
Kind of hard to tell on this one.
Right, because, there's some of them that are, like, a bit see-through. They're like to show you the antenna.
Yeah, the Amex. You know? I had an old Amex that had that, too, which is cool.
Right.
I mean, but that's all passive. And people then say, oh, well, you should put tinfoil in your wallet. And
Right. It's like,
Right. It's interesting how that stuff works, though. I don't know, though. I honestly, I haven't looked into the usage too much, but it's coming to the state. I mean, it's on the way.
Right. So, but how many places you've been to actually have it, have the capability to
use
it?
Like almost all of them have the new readers now with the slide in.
Oh, really?
But,
okay, right.
But not all of them use it yet. That's what I'm saying. Like some of them start in October, but all of them will by January, basically.
Got it.
So,
yeah,
it'll be really interesting to see how that changes stuff.
Well, it's only last year here early this year, that they did away with the signing, the signature thing.
That's good.
You can no longer accept a signature.
Yeah.
as, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's cool. It's
so
cool.
That's been completely done
looking
away.
At this. I mean, like, really, the pin, it almost looks like a SIM card type of pad, right? But
yep.
Yeah, it's just a little piece of silicon. There's actually, in this article, you can see a shot of the silicon as well. There's like an X-ray shot, so pretty neat.
Yep.
So yeah.
No, we've had these for a decade.
Right, but
sorry, dude.
Have you had hackers?
Yeah.
Soldering to get around them.
Yeah, but it's like you hear about these things, but
yeah, I know.
Like, it's not like, oh, a million people
right,
lost all
right,
their
right,
money.
Right,
like,
right, right. That happens, know, in like, the digital realm more anyways.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, yeah, there might be an occasional article where, oh, you know, some hacker has gotten into a service station, which is a petrol gas station, yeah. I guess you call it, and they're secretly replaced the pin machine with another one, you
yeah,
know,
spoofer.
Like they actually swapped it over, yeah, while the person wasn't looking, and then they came and, you know, stole, you know, and it's usually detected in a few days, and like, you know, 50 people or 100 people have been scammed,
right,
you know,
right.
Like it's,
yep.
Yeah. You know, it's like those just, ATM
so much work, you know,
skimming machines, right? Yeah, like those ATM skimming machines, though.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, same thing, except that doesn't magnetically, like, right? That's the stripe.
Yes, well, it gets the stripe, and then they use a secret hidden camera to record your PIN number, type in, you know?
Right.
And these things usually last for a day before the, you know, people come back in, the scammers come back in and take it back out, because otherwise it gets found.
Oh, because they store it, you're saying?
And,
like, they store it locally.
Yeah, so they store the whole idea is that they store the card as it's going into the machine, so they've got the swipe,
yeah.
And then they can, but they can't, when you got the chip and PIN
mm-hmm.
thing, you know, they can't do that.
Yeah.
Right, so
yeah, because you actually need the authentication piece of it. So.
Yeah, but the whole idea is they don't use it to buy stuff. They go to the ATM machine and take out money. That's what they do. So all you need to do that is the thing on the back, right? Is the magnetic swipe. So they scan the magnetic swipe, and they've got the camera set up. They hide a camera in there that looks down at the keypad, so they can see your see your PIN number you type in as well.
Right.
And then bingo. And then they leave it there for a day, and, you know, there's 50 people use the machine. So they come back in, take it away, and bingo. They've got 50 cards with 50 machines. They go to back to the ATM, and they make a card, you know.
Yep.
You can easily buy a $10, you know, card.
Straight programmer,
and
yep.
Blank cards
yep.
on eBay.
Yep.
Yep. And, they go stick it in, and, yep. And they withdraw, you know, the less than $1,000 maximum or whatever from each person, and bam, you know.
Bob's your uncle, I believe you say.
Bob's your uncle.
Yeah. All right, one last thing. I know that we're getting out of time here.
We're over time.
Nah, one last thing. Because it's a former guest. So Philip, who's been on the show before, have you seen this Osh Chip thing that he did? So it's on the list.
I have not seen Osh Chip.
So basically he took a Cortex M0 with a Bluetooth.
Oh yes, it's a little dip thing. It's a little dip.
Yeah,
patch.
And then he converted it into a dip. And I've actually seen it at work. It's really fun because, like, so the demo Philip was showing me was basically like he put like a serial signal into one of the pins, and then he had another chip, and basically it can just create a pipe between pins. And so you had a serial signal coming into one pin, and then it like bounced between that chip and the other chip, and then it went out the pin on the other chip. And it's just like, it seems really like that. Obviously, that was a very simple example, but it's just like, oh, it's magical.
Magic, yeah. Because, like, if people can't visualize, well, of course you can't visualize it. We haven't told you yet. It's basically a 16 pin dip, 2, 4, 6, 8.
16
pin dip package.
Yeah.
Tiny little board, so it fits in your breadboard as a regular dip chip,
yeah.
And it's got an ARM Cortex M0 on it, plus a Bluetooth low energy ant.
Yeah, 2.4 gig radio that can have the
2.4
stack.
Gig
yeah.
thingo.
Yeah,
yeah, with a little antenna, all in a 16 pin dip chip.
Right,
and it's just pretty cool.
Yeah, and so
why don't they go the whole hog and actually encapsulate it?
Oh, like to, I think, put I think the polyamide might be kind of a tough process. Making a board's
right.
one thing, but dipping it in polyamide right. is a little bit more. So
anyway, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. So
I like it.
Yeah, so I think Philip's, we heard about this via Twitter. I mean, I've seen it before in person, but I think Philip's on the verge of shipping, I think, or has shipped. So I wanted to mention it. It's pretty fun. So, but yeah, tiny parts, you know, like, thinking about what's actually inside the dip package.
But it's all about the software environment for it. Like, yeah. You know, how do you use it? Like, does it come pre-programmed with, you know, like, is it an Arduino-y type?
Oh, right, like drag and drop almost.
Library interface, yeah. Kind of thing. Like, how easy is it to use? Like, yeah, I mean, yeah, you can have a board with an ARM micro and a transceiver chip and antenna on it, but yeah. Meh, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure we talk to Philip every once in a while, so I'm sure we'll hear from him more about this as well. But it's great little form factor. And
yeah, it's cool. Yeah, it's very cute.
Very. I'm surprised people are still using breadboards, to be honest. Like, I know that it's still super simple with, you know, if you have the parts and everything, but like, damn, they are not great.
You just answered your own question.
Right. Just because people have the parts still, you're saying, or
the parts and it's simple.
Yeah, I mean, I get that part. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have the parts though. That's the thing. I don't stock through-hole parts in my lab. I have 1K and 10K resistors for like bodging, but don't.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Right. No. It's. Yeah.
Not all of us were offered an entire through-hole lab, Dave.
Right.
Which you didn't even take.
Okay, yes. No, I didn't take it. Exactly. Yeah, I could have bought it all for $500.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, it's just, I don't think, like, I don't tell anyone that they should do that these days either. You know, like, you can get it. You can, it's good for some prototyping stuff, but most of the time it's like, man, just dead bug it or, you know, cut a board or something. Manhattan style. Right. I don't know. Like, there's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of ways, so.
And that segues very nicely into, I will mention that my new product is almost here.
Yes.
But I'm not going to say what it is.
I will. No, I won't.
Anyway, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, I've seen it. It's very useful. I think it'll be great.
You think it's useful?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really useful.
Would you buy some?
I think so. I think.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right.
Excellent. All right. It's coming. My samples are on the way. So I've got photos at the moment. I actually tweeted a manufacturing photo of it. And yes. But I'm
treasure hunt time.
We'll see. Hopefully. Yeah, hopefully it's right. You can't see enough detail in the photos to know that they've done it right. So until you actually get it in your hands and, you know, actually try it and, you know, actually fondle it and play with it.
Yep.
Nothing beats hands-on fondling. No.
That's right, folks. Dave Jones says nothing beats hands-on fondling.
I am a fondler. Yep. Yep. I'm a product fiddler. Yep.
All right. Well, with that, we are going to sign off before Dave incriminates himself anymore. Talk to you next week.
Catch you next time. I'm a product fiddler.
Here
yep.
In our little village of Anatevka, you might say every one of us is a fiddler on
yep.
the roof.
I'm a product fiddler.
Trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking his neck. It isn't easy.
I am a fondler.
You may ask, why do we stay up there if it's so dangerous?
Nothing beats hands-on fondling, no.